want to thank organizers to putting together this wonderful program. So today I'm presenting about this, basically about these bounds for on the average treatment effect in terms of the instrument of variable models. As we know, there are stronger bounds known as the Bohr-Pearl bounds and the weaker bounds known as the natural or Rogozhensky bounds. I'm just going to use this chance to clarify how this relates to the assumptions we make and also the Lidin variables. So I guess this talk is more or less motivated by the question, why statisticians, as I am a statistician, should care about this business of CHSH or Bell-type inequalities. So the purpose is trying to present to you a concrete example where this is an issue that comes up for the study of partial identification, where you care about some causal quantity, but you can't get uniquely identify the quantity from the observed distribution, and you have to seek bounds. And I want to say that you probably do want to understand these inequalities in order to obtain the sharpest bounds. So once again, this is the instrument of variable model DAG, which I'm sure you have seen many times today. And I'm just focusing on the case where the instruments, the treatment, and the outcome Y, they are all binary. And I use this potential outcome notation Y of x, little z to denote the counterfactual potential outcome, how to impose and intervene the little x to x and the little z to z. And it's important that here I make no assumptions about the state space of this latent variable u that confounds the x and the y. And of course, as we know, this is the case where you can't uniquely identify the value of this average treatment. In fact, the average treatment, in fact, is defined as the mean, the difference between the mean of this counterfactual y of x, z, where you flip the value of x and without loss of generality, set the value of z at the baseline. You can't uniquely identify this from the observed distribution of x, y, and z. Instead, we want to somehow seek the sharpest possible bounds of this quantity. And we also have seen this today. So basically, this is phenomenal paper 97, Falken and Pearl. They obtained the sharp bounds, this quantity tau. So you don't have to look too closely at the expression, but just to remember, the lower bound is a maximum of 8 quantities, and the upper bound is a minimum of 8 quantities, and these quantities are linear or affine in the distribution of x, y, and z. So there are different ways you can establish the Bohr-Pearl bounds, but I'm just going to focus on one way. They're usually established and proven to be sharp under the following two so-called cross-world assumptions. The two cross-world assumptions are this individual level exclusion and the joint exogeneity. So individual level exclusion says the random variable, the two potential outcomes where you keep the same value of x, but you flip the value of z, with the probability of one, they're equal. So that means for every individual, there is no effect from z whatsoever at all. So this basically would also justify, as more commonly written in the literature, that y of xz is only a function of x. And this assumption obviously is cross-world because you can't simultaneously observe these two values. The other assumption is this joint exogeneity that supposes that the z is independent jointly of these four counterfactuals, or if you assume the first one, the two counterfactuals. So this is called joint exogeneity because z is independent of the random vector consisting of all the counterfactuals. So basically these two assumptions which justify the Bohr-Pearl bounds, they are both cross-world. And this could be an issue when we pose those conditions, because for the first one, the individual level exclusion, even if in a scenario where you can run a randomized experiment where you can randomize both the and x, you have no way of consistently testing the first assumption. And for the second one, depending on who you talk to, basically, it might seem a little bit implausible if you say this is an assumption made on observational studies. So the second assumption can, of course, hold by design if you can randomize Z, but in cases where Z is not randomized, then, you know, again, it would be a little bit dubious to justify in observational studies. So the natural question is then, can we replace these cross-world assumptions by their respective single-world assumptions and then derive the bounds on the average treatment path? So this is what I'm going to do, but before doing that, let me just add a little extra to the question just to better connect with the literature. So I'm going to assume there is a counterfactual of X indexed by the little z. And also I'm going to introduce, there is a confounder, a separate confounder U prime that is also latent, that is between Z and X, but it's important this confounder U prime is independent of the confounder U between X and Y. So these are little extras that just to better connect with the existing literature, and there is no essential role played by these two extras. So basically you can run the same argument I'm going to present without having these two extras. Okay, so now I'm going to replace the aforementioned two cross-world assumptions by their respective single-world assumptions. And an easy way to read off their counterparts is to look at this single-world intervention graph corresponding to this latent variable depth. So the first one is exactly encoded, the exclusion restriction is exactly encoded by this missing edge from Z to Y, as in the DAG, this missing edge from this split fixed node little z to this counterfactual Y of XZ. And you can read off from this wig, without this dashed edge, then this Y of XZ condition on U is independent of this fixed vertex little z. What that means is that conditioned on the latent variable U, the y of x zero has the same distribution as the y of x one. So where you flip the value of zero to one, that doesn't change this conditional distribution. So that is why this exclusion is called the latent variable stochastic exclusion. Stochastic means this is equal in distribution as opposed to the earlier condition where you require the two random variables to coincide. Because we're working with binary random variables, the equal in distribution can be replaced by the equal in conditional mean. So the second counterpart is the counterpart for exogeneity. Again, you can use the swig to read off that Z is independent of the latent U, and the Y of XZ condition on U is independent of both big Z and the counterfactual of X little z. And I call the second condition the latent variable marginal exogeneity. So what is called marginal? So basically you can read off from these two statements that Z is marginally independent of every of this Y of little x little z individually. So there are four marginal independences, as opposed to the previous one, the Z has to be independent jointly of this random vector. Okay, so these are the two single world assumptions we're going to posit, and these assumptions are just can be read off from this week. Okay, now I'm going to use those assumptions, replace those assumptions, and to derive the bound of the ACE on the average treatment effect. I'm going to do this with linear programming. So I'm going to create this linear program with two sets of programming variables. The first set of programming variable is this conditional probability table of all the counterfactuals conditioned on the two arms of Z. This is the first set. The second set is the two sets of conditional observed distributions of X, Y conditioned on Z. And of course, these are binary. And it's important for the way I'm doing the linear program here, because I don't want to say anything about the state space view. Here, I just basically does not relate U at all in the program. So U and U prime are not part of this program. And then I'm going to enforce the constraints. These conditional probability tables, they have to be simplex, so they have to be non-negative and sum to one. These are the constraints. And then these two sets of programming variables, they are related by this consistency condition, where you let the little x, little y, and the little z to run over the binary zero ones. And then I'm going to impose the previous two single world assumptions. But however, here, the single word assumptions makes reference to this latent variable u, which I don't wish them to enter my program. So somehow I have to eliminate this quantifier u. So elimination in this case is rather simple, just integrate out this u. And then you get the stochastic exclusion by integrating out u and the marginal exogeneity, as I mentioned earlier, by integrating out u. And then these two assumptions remain single world, and they are just conditions where you can express using this conditional counterfactual probability table. And these are affine in the conditional probability table. And then because I want to get a bound on tau, and also add a tau, which is the affine function of the counterfactual probability table, as a programming variable, and this defines a degenerate convex polytope. And I use Frere masking or other algorithm to project onto the coordinates. So to get the convex polytope projected on the coordinates of the observed distribution and this quantity tau. Then here is what I get. I get actually not the previous Bakke-Porro bounds, but instead I get the so-called natural bounds or the the Robbins-Masky bounds. So compared to the Bakke-Porro bounds, this is a strictly looser bounds in the sense that the lower bound is maximum over the only four terms instead of the eight. And the same holds for the upper bound as well. So somehow we get a weaker bounds compared to the previous Bakke-Porro bounds. So the talk is basically to investigate this question. So what is the cause of this gap between the two sets of the bounds? And is this gap due to the fact that we replace the cross-world counterfactual assumptions with the single world assumptions? So just to recall, I started this talk with the individual exclusion and joint exogeneity, and these are cross-world assumptions. And then I say I want to replace those assumptions by their single-world counterparts, which are latent variable stochastic exclusion and latent variable marginal exclusion exogeneity. And these assumptions, by integrating out u, the latent u, that gives the single-world stochastic exclusion and the single-world marginal exogeneity. So the leftmost two assumptions, these two, they are cross-world, and while the four on the right, they are single-world. So it's perfectly reasonable to guess the previous gap is due to the gap between the cross-world and the single-world. But I'm going to say that this is not the case, actually. And it is the gap. The gap is exactly due to this translation. It's due to this quantifier elimination where it eliminated this latent u. So basically, the gap exactly stems from the fact that when we derive the stochastic exclusion from the latent variable stochastic exclusion and the margin exogeneity from the latent variable margin exogeneity by integrating out U, we have missed the CH-SH inequality implied just by the sheer existence of this latent variable U. So next, I show that this is exactly the case. We can basically close this gap by adding in the CHSE inequality. So again, this is the swig. And if I twist the limbs of the swig for a little bit, and then this just looks like the famous Bell's diagram. So it's not a surprise that there is going to be, once you assume that there is a latent U, there is going to be a CHSH inequality. So here I work in the case where I introduce this counterfactual X of Z, but the same argument would hold if you don't introduce of this X counterfactual at all. So the CHSH inequality is this bound of the correlations. And similarly, basically we can translate this inequality into our case. And this is the translation. This is this Bell CHSH inequality implying of this swig. And if you look at this, this is a condition where we can impose on this counterfactual conditional probability table, because this is condition is also affine in this object. So I'm going to close the gap now, try to close the gap by rerunning my linear program. So same as before, I code all these constraints, the simplex, the consistency, and the single word assumptions. Now I just add in my magic potion, in this case, the CHSH inequalities. And I do the same thing. And lo and behold, we just recover the Bokeh-Perl bounds. So basically, let me summarize a bit. So basically, under this binary instrumental variable model, then under the latent variable stochastic exclusion and latent variable margin exogeneity, which are conditions that you can read out from the population level swig for the latent variable DAC, the Bokeh-Perl bounds hold and sharp for the average treatment depth. This is what we have shown. So I guess for the physicists in this audience, this may come as no surprise, because you would say, of course, this is the case. But let me just try to reinterpret what this means if you're like me, a statistician or an econometrician. So just imagine for the moment, if you're a statistician and you work on the IV and all you want to conceptualize are those objects, the Z, X of Z, and a counterfactual Y of little Z, little X. So there is no latent variable U whatsoever that you want to conceptualize at this moment. Then also suppose all you want to posit are the single word assumptions. In this case, the stochastic exclusion and the margin exogeneity. Both of those assumptions do not relate to a latent variable U. Then the question investigated in my talk is basically, what is this extra minimal condition now that we need on these objects, on the Z, X and Z, and Y, X and Z, such that we can justify the Bokeh-Perl bounds? And the answer is exactly this CHSH inequality, which of course would be implied if at the first place there is going to be a latent confounder U. So let me just summarize this little story. The conclusion is that the Bokeh-Perl bounds does not really rely on the untestable cross-word assumptions, such as such as the individual level exclusion and joint exogeneity. Instead, they can be perfectly justified just by the swig or FFRCISTG interpretation of the causal model plus the CHSH inequality. Of course, the CHSH inequality is automatically implied if there exists a latent variable U in the first place. And of course, one could argue then that you just said single word, but CHSH by itself is cross word. But that I admit that is true, but this crossword is not a crossword assumption per se, is a consequence by the existence of the variable U. And I also want to point out in the literature, actually, Phil David, in his earlier paper, he actually showed the Brocky-Pearl bounds and their tightness with the help of Litton variable. But I guess David famously objects the use of counterfactuals. So somehow he didn't explicitly use counterfactuals in his derivation, but used something I would say very similar. So again, I want to say that for statisticians, the lesson here is that if we are really after the sharp bounds, then it's a good idea to understand the CHS or Bell inequalities, and also to read off the single world constraints from a graph that would contain both the observed and the counterfactual variables. And also linear programming can be a very useful tool, which has been, I think, very clear from today's talk. So a part of this material I presented can be found in my PhD thesis. And I also want to mention the way I did the linear programming in this case explicitly did not involve the Litton variable U. But I guess alternatively, you could include U in those linear variables by, with all its generality, assume a relatively large cardinality on such U. For example, I think 2^4, 16 would suffice in this case. So basically, if you want to include U directly in the linear program, you could use what Jean just talked about earlier. And then you don't have to add in the CHS inequality, then it just holds by itself because the latent variable U already exists in your linear program. So I guess that's all my talk. Thank you very much.
Right. So thank you, Richard. That was great. Would you mind going back to your summary slide for a second? Because mm-hmm. there was something here that confused me, which is that you first said that CHSH is a cross-world fact. But then a few bullet points later, you said that field data derived the bounds. Okay, I guess that's not a contradiction, but he derived it without cross-world facts. So there's something I can about what is it that makes CHSH a cross-world fact?
What makes CHSH a cross-world fact? So if you look at the CHSH inequality, that would involve random variables that are living in two different worlds, right?
So there is no way to.
Right. So basically the takeaway message is that you need something cross-world for the Brocky-Pearl bounds, for the stronger bounds. But the thing is to differentiate whether you are making those as assumptions and whether that is a fact that follows from the existence of latent variable. So I think we should make such a distinction.
I also have a very minor comment. Can you go back to where your swig is with, along with the observed data graph? So you have, you were making population level exclusions at some point, right? So this is, maybe there's a question for Thomas and Jamie. So if you're gonna make population level exclusions, is it correct to say that somehow the observed data graph has to have an edge from Z to Y, but when you split, you somehow that edge goes away or something like that? I think it has to do with one of the chapters of the SWIG paper where they reinterpret SWIG's beam.
I never said there exists an edge from Z to Y. No. I just meant to say there is not such a dashed edge from Z to Y.
But yeah, I thought that there were two different interpretations of SWIGs, one of which is individual level and one of which is population level. And you were talking about the population level one, right?
That's right.
But my point is that if you're going to make a population, if your SWIG on this slide has a population level interpretation, then certainly the edge from Z to Y in the SWIG should not be there. But mm-hmm. on the observed data diagram from which the SWIG came from, probably the edge should be there because you're not ruling out the existence of individual level effects, which is what those arrows mean.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Anyway, this is very minor. I just asked.
But not if it's a population level SWIG, right?
No. That's not minor at all.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly the difference, which is that like you're allowing for.
Yeah. But I'm not asking about the SWIG, Robin. I'm asking about the observed data diagram.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Sorry, maybe I can ask a question that's kind of related to this. So there's a strong overlap between what you said, Richard, and what was in my tutorial on Monday, where I talked about the instrumental scenario where the instrument was three valued. And there we know that the Pearl inequalities for the compatibility constraints are necessary but not sufficient, and the Bonnet inequalities are giving some extra constraints. And then I talked about a technique that's kind of like inflation, but allows you to intervene on some variables. So it's basically exactly the graph you've drawn here, this single world intervention graph.
Mm-hmm.
And I described how, like, if you only use the deseparation relations on that, you'll get the Pearl inequalities. And if you furthermore use Bell type constraints for that scenario, you'll get the Bonnet inequalities. And you know, Ellie was the one who explained this to me after seeing your, this is some of Ellie's work, and it's very similar to what you're describing at the level of these bounds. So my question is, it seems to me like when we think about inflation and stuff, that we have sort of two attitudes that you could take towards those inflated DAGs and those DAGs where you intervene. On the one hand, you could think about them as like twin networks, where you're sort of describing counterfactual worlds that have some elements in common. On the other hand, you could just say, that's just a different causal structure, but it has some symmetries among the parameters. And so my question is, when you talk about whether it's a single world or a cross world, like when in particular you said, David derived this bulk ape Pearl result, but without using counterfactuals, does it really just boil down to like whether you're thinking about this other graph as, you know, like a new causal possibility, or whether you're thinking of it as like a twin network?
The twin network versus what? Can you explain?
I'll try. I don't know, maybe Ellie's gonna try.
One of the ways that we think about inflation is we say, if your distribution was generated by this causal process, and you really believe that there's a hidden variable model, then you say, look, there's gonna be this thought experiment, which is if I recycle the same causal components, there should exist a distribution in some other experiment that I did not perform. And you can do this for the Bell scenario, where we have these sort of two outcomes, an outcome for Alice, an outcome for Bob, settings for Alice, and settings for outcome. If you really believe that there's a hidden variable, U, which is what's relevant, and X sort of depends on you functionally, and similarly for Bob, then you could say, I believe that there exists some thought experiment where the value of the hidden variable, which is just some hidden number, doesn't just go to sort of two places, but at the same time, every event, it actually goes to four places. And so we get two outcomes for Alice-like experiments, except they could be doing different, querying different settings at the same time, and the same thing for Bob. And if you just posit the existence of such a distribution, that if one could do such an experiment, by virtue of the fact that we assume is a Hindmer model, then the existence of a distribution in this thought experiment, which has consistency conditions and relates certain marginals back to what you see, gives you the CHSH inequality. And that's a way of sort of saying, like, it's not about cross-world counterfactuals, it's about capturing consequences of a hidden variable model. But another way of doing that is to sort of say, like, don't think about this as a thought experiment about some experiment you could perform, recycling the same causal components. Imagine that you have like a twin network and you're actually now talking about different worlds which share something in common. And now it's exactly the same sort of pictorial thing and the same consistency conditions on the marginals, which is interpreting it about counterfactuals and the existence of cross-world counterfactuals and the statement about cross-world counterfactuals. And I think what Rob is saying is, the answer to Ilya's question is, if you truly believe in a hidden variable model, consequences of there is a hidden rare model are the strongest possible statements that you would want to make, or at least very strong statements, about cross-world counterfactuals. Much stronger than population-level exclusion, much stronger than population-level exogeneity. The fact that there exists a hidden rare model means that you could draw a thought experiment where you could relate counterfactuals, but they wouldn't involve single-world counterfactuals. You could express the cross-world counterfactuals as margins of an experiment that you really could perform if there was a hidden variable model.
Okay, I think you're asking Richard. I think I disagree with you, but I will answer later because you're not asking me right now. You're asking Richard.
I'm sure I can. I'm not sure I can totally understand the question. But my impression of this is that I guess to get the bucket pearl balance, you have to imagine it somehow use the fact that there is one world that those cross-world functionals, they live in that one world. And it is that precisely the existence of this random variable that shows or manifests that there is one such world, I think. But I guess I'm coming from a different perspective where I want to separate the single world versus cross-world causal assumptions, or the causal model, assumptions on the causal model, and versus those implied by existence of such a single, such a world encompassing different counterfactuals. So I guess I'm coming from a different perspective, so I can't really answer a question. So I'll hand over to Ilya.
Well, yeah, I was
typing
up the answer, but I think I'll just say the way Ellie says it, it sounds like there is no room for stuff like heuristics at all, because heuristics assume hidden variables just fine, but they're just not willing to assume anything cross-world. That's just the thing about that model. So the way you would properly draw heuristic is a U that points to everything. It's just that you're lucky, and it's a special U with a special structure, such that anytime you construct a swig, and only a swig, bunch of edges from this U disappear in a way that's helpful. But as soon as you start doing things like twin networks, where you start talking about cross-world variables at the same time in the same graph, suddenly that U messes everything up. And anytime you find yourself comparing a variable in one world and in another, you will find that U is a parent of them. So never will it allow anything like that, basically. So I think that's the way it gets cashed out in the heuristic.
So I think I would be okay with that. But this idea of, like, if you believe you have a causal model, then you could take these causal parameters and combine them in another way. So you could, like, in particular, broadcast U. But if you're in this, like, first thing model where there's really a U everywhere, and it's only when you look at one swig at a time that you see these independencies, then you would not recover the CHH inequality, because you could and you wouldn't recover Bonnet inequality. These are not consequences of those causal models. They're only consequences of NPSC MIE, which is sort of captured by noting that in an NPSC MIE, the thought experiment that you could perform implies these kind of independencies on cross-world counterfactuals, which don't follow from the first.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I was just making a narrow point, which is that I don't think it's necessary to equate hidden variable theories with cross-world stuff. I think that's the whole swig game, is you don't have to do that, basically. That's my take. But yeah, you're right, of course, you're gonna get stronger that's the point of the talk, right? You get a nicer results, basically, if you assume.
Okay, well, there doesn't seem to be any more questions, Richard. So we're going to adjourn for the day. So thanks very much for your talk.
Yeah, thank you.